We are celebrating Insight's 15th birthday this summer by listening back to some of our favorite episodes. Today, a one-hour special from 2016 based on the harrowing and nearly unbelievable experiences of a combat pilot named Don Harton. He flew missions from the very earliest days of what became the Vietnam War.
I watched in very slow motion as the big gray shape came and an 18,000-pound drop tank was coming right into the cockpit.
Don would have to eject.
I squeezed the trigger here, and nothing happened.
In today's rebroadcast, you'll hear my conversation with Don Harton as he retells his story. His nephew, Craig Collins, joined us. He told it all in a book from 2016 titled Midair. I'm Beth Ruriak. The Midair story in this encore episode of Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Our entire hour is devoted to the story of one vet, retired Air Force pilot Major Don Harton. He started his military career in 1964 at Mather Air Force Base in Sacramento, California. But less than a year later, Don would become part of one of the most dramatic accidents in history— a mid-air collision of B-52 bombers over the South China Sea. You're going to hear him tell the story himself, but here's the other part. Don's nephew, Craig Collins, was little when this happened. He remembers giving a kindergarten presentation about his Uncle Don's accident. He says he held a B-52 model airplane and a newspaper clipping. But Craig's fascination with the story never ended. Over the years, he read, he researched, he asked his Uncle Don endless questions, and he checked history. 51 years after that accident, Craig published a book. He titled it Midair. During this hour, you're going to hear the story. Both men sat down with me in the studio a few weeks ago. Craig tells part of it, but most of it will come from Major Harton himself. And I think, as you hear what happened, you'll wonder, like I did, how in the world did Don Harton survive?
My name's Don Harton, and I grew up in Idaho. All I ever wanted to do was fly airplanes, but when I finally got through pilot training and all the other stuff, I wound up at Mather Air Force Base here in Sacramento. I loved it. So I got checked out on a crew, and here I was, a proud member of SAC. I thought it was kind of neat, but here I was, a second lieutenant on a base full of navigator second lieutenants as a co-pilot. I'm a pilot. I'm not a navigator. But all the girls, they thought that was kind of fun to be interested in some second lieutenant, even if they were navigators. And I'm just joking. I love navigators.
Kind of joking, though, right, Craig? He was a ladies' man, and your mom is his sister. So she was always teasing him and watching out for him.
Yeah, I recall one time one of my mom's favorite stories is he came roaring up in his red MG and stopped in front of the house. And my mom came out and gave him a hug and a kiss. And then they went inside, and my dad came home from work a couple hours later, and he was the kind of guy that just drew attention. And so all the women in the neighborhood had seen him drive up, and so my dad got out of his car, and these women came up to him and said, "Oh, Mr. Collins, I'm not sure you want to go in there." And he said, "Why not?" "Oh, your wife's in there with another man, and he's been in there for a couple hours." And my dad looked, and he said, "That's just my brother-in-law." And so, but he was the kind of guy that just really drew attention. He was definitely very handsome, and he was a pilot, and it's interesting time for sure.
His hair is now white, his mustache too. The major looks younger, though, than his mid-70s. He's wearing a bright red Nellis Air Force Base shirt that reads Don Harton, but he says to everyone he meets, "Just call me Don." His nephew Craig is sitting to his right.
Yeah, I'm Craig Collins, and I grew up in Carson City, and he was stationed at Mather Air Force Base, so he would come visit us on leave quite frequently. He would roar up in his red MG with silver spoked wheels, and he had aviator sunglasses and a bomber jacket, and he was the coolest uncle any kid ever had. When I was about 5 years old. I came to Sacramento, and he put me on the back of his Honda motorcycle, and we tore off across the tarmac at Mather Air Force Base, and he drove me right up to a B-52 and got to kick the tires and walk around, told me all about it. It left, obviously, a huge impression on me. His crash into the South China Sea on June 18th, 1965, happened about 2 months before I went into kindergarten, and I had to give a show and tell. So I brought in a plastic B-52 and a newspaper clipping of his crash, and it was literally the first story I ever told in public.
Don was trained to pilot B-52s outfitted with nuclear bombs. This was the era of the Cold War, Russia was the enemy, and any missions were expected to be in Arctic-like conditions. The Mather crews even trained at Donner Pass in the snow. But by 1965, the United States was eyeing the conflict in Southeast Asia, and that created a change in assignment for the Sacramento crews. They would be sent to Guam, and instead of nuclear bombs, the B-52s would carry traditional iron bombs.
We were the fifth B-52 to take off out of here for Guam. And we landed there expecting to go and end the Vietnam War before it got started.
This is February 1965, by the way, and it was only days after some Viet Cong forces overran a military helicopter compound in central South Vietnam and killed 26 American troops and wounded about 126 others. And then Lyndon Johnson on February 11th, I believe, sent 36 B-52s to Guam, and they were supposed to be there for 12 hours and load up with bombs and fuel, and then they were going to take out the North Vietnamese air power completely.
So we were going to go down to 500 feet, fly along the coast of North Vietnam and up over Haiphong and then over Hanoi at probably still 500 feet over the water, but that would be about 250 to 300 feet above Hanoi and Haiphong, pop up and destroy the MiG airfield at Phuc Yen. But we didn't do it. Instead, we sat on the beach for 4.5 months. There was, we didn't know it at the time, but Vang Pao had a major, and I love the Hmong people. I marched with them here in Sacramento.
Those are the Laotian people.
The Laotian Hmong. They populate the Central Valley now. They're wonderful people. But they were fighting already, and we didn't know it.
The B-52s, their pilots, their crews, they just waited in Guam for orders to be sent home or a new mission. The U.S. wasn't in the Vietnam War yet at this point. Those reports of fighting were coming from a place that few of the airmen even knew about.
In fact, when they said, oh, it's starting, there's something going on over there, and they said, where's Laos? And I'm a geography nut, so I knew where it was at, but nobody else knew where Laos was. Well, where's Vietnam? Where's Hanoi? Nobody cared. It was not part of the world thought at the time.
But the conflict was escalating, and the U.S. was about to jump into it. When we come back, Major Harton continues his story. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. You are listening to a special hour of Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In August of 1964, Don Harton arrived at Mather Air Force Base in Sacramento, California, as a young second lieutenant. This was the era of the Cold War. Crews were on alert for missions to Russia, and Don was trained to pilot a B-52 carrying nuclear bombs. But by early 1965, the United States was stepping up its involvement in Southeast Asia. The crews that thought they'd be on a mission to Russia were instead sent to Guam for what was supposed to be a quick assignment. But one change in strategy led to another, and a nearly unbelievable story unfolded with Don Harton as a central character. The story is told in the book Mid-Air, written by Craig Collins. He and his uncle Don Harton came to our studio recently to retell it.
it just started escalating a little bit at a time. There was nothing really much going on, but there were our special forces advisors over there, and they kept attacking them and killing them. And finally, America kind of got involved in the Vietnam War, and we had to start thinking about it, but it was, we were nuclear. That's beside the point. We don't need it. And then they assigned the Mather wing and a Barksdale, Louisiana wing to fly with what we called iron bombs. They were basically World War II 750 and 1,000-pound bombs. And they could load a lot of those on a B-52, so they said, okay, you guys are going to train with these in case something happens in Vietnam. And so we went out and we practiced with little tiny marker bombs, but one crew, I think, got to drop the real bombs, one full load here in the States, before we left. Then suddenly they attacked the Pleiku Helicopter Center and killed a bunch of our people, wounded them, and Johnson said, okay, you guys deploy. So on February 11th, 1965, we left Mather Air Force Base with three tankers, three bombers, three tankers, three bombers, until we got all of our planes off, and we all went to Guam. I was the fifth B-52 to land in Guam, and there were, I mean, hundreds after that. But we were the point of the spear.
The mission that this book and your story are based on, was that your first B-52 mission?
Well, we trained here in the States a lot, but that was the first B-52 combat, first time SAC ever went to war in history. So it was a big deal.
Don describes their quick assignment in Southeast Asia, destroy a MiG airfield and return home. But once they got to Guam, those orders were canceled. And rather than go home, the crews and their planes were kept in Guam waiting.
We sat there for 4.5 months before we actually got a mission. And this was finally the mission, ArcLight 1. ArcLight was the code word for B-52 operations throughout most of the war. And 1, of course, was its first mission. So we took off out of here with all these Mather crews, and everybody had been in SAC for quite a long time, but they were bomber-oriented, thinking nuclear. We were now conventional warfare.
But that mission started the Vietnam War in earnest.
Yeah, it did. And we could have ended the Vietnam War on February 15th, had they let us do it. But Lyndon Johnson and Robert McNamara were, I'm going to say it, they were chicken. They were just not into it. And they wouldn't let us fight.
Craig, you do write some of the backstory of the battle of the two generals. And which one was President Johnson going to choose?
Yeah, I did some research, obviously. And essentially what it came down to was there were two approaches to the war. One was the gradualism policy that Johnson and McNamara pursued. The other was, you know, it's one of the doctrines of warfare that goes back to the Civil War. You know, get there the first with the most. That, I think, essentially was the B-52 mission in February 1965. But Johnson came down to it, and he just didn't want to be seen as the president of a rich first world country bombing a third world country that had no manufacturing capability. And he just didn't want to be seen that way. So he and McNamara figured that they could run some fighter sorties and that sort of thing, and the North Vietnamese would turn tail and head back north. And that's not what happened. They ended up in a land war in Southeast Asia that cost 58,000 lives and, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops injured and 8 years of carnage. So it's really unfortunate.
The people here in the States were told, we lost the war, we lost this, we lost that. We did not. We won every major battle, and we won the war 5 times over. And I was there. I was reading the classified reports. It was over. They were trying to surrender. Nope. Too much money to be made on this, and a lot of other things.
On the day you took off, Don, there was a weather forecast.
We knew all about it. We left Guam knowing there was a typhoon over the area. So we knew it was there, but it wasn't going to affect us because we were going to overfly it. But it did suck us in, and we were 9 minutes early on the first mission.
Explain this.
Okay. B-52s have to refuel with KC-135s, and there were R-135s out of Mather also, but they always flew in a cell of three. Lead is here, 500 feet, and a mile behind is two.
As Don's talking, he puts his right hand in front of him to represent plane number one. He lines up his left hand a bit behind to be plane number two. And his eyes, he says, would be the position of plane number three. And that's the plane that he was co-piloting.
We were green three. We had 10 cells of three B-52s each. That's 30 B-52s on the first raid. Mather was leading with five of these cells. Barksdale was behind us with five more. We went into a refueling track where they had, I won't get into the mistakes they made on that, but they put the refueling tracks 25 miles apart instead of 50 like they were supposed to. Typhoon Dinah was there, fourth largest typhoon in the history of the world, and it kind of sucked us from Guam toward the Philippines rather rapidly. Anyway, we got there 9 minutes early.
Are all three of you 9 minutes early, or?
Everybody was 9 minutes early. Yeah.
So why doesn't the whole formula just adjust then?
Because they had radio silence and they said, do this way. And everybody was of this SAC, Curtis LeMay nuclear mindset and not thinking for themselves like fighter pilots do. So we got there and this cell leader decided to do a 360-degree turn.
And that is a decision that set the collision in motion. Craig explains in his book that the cell leader wasn't even supposed to be the leader that day. It was his first mission. But here he was, and now at 30,000 feet, he was starting a turn to eat up those extra 9 minutes.
And it wasn't really his fault. It was SAC left us hanging like that, and we were just, we were there 9 minutes early, and the general said in the briefing, he said, be at the aerial refueling control point on time. It's very important. So this guy, that's what he did.
Bathroom breaks were happening at this very same moment.
Well, we always have to go downstairs to relieve ourselves before aerial refueling, and this is at night.
And Don, not knowing about the turn, had unstrapped for his break and left the cockpit. When he came back, the pilot took his turn.
He went downstairs, and I was strapping in when suddenly the lead plane in a cell turned left. And I said, hey, radar, Terry Lowry. Hey, radar, what are they doing, a 360? And he said, Roger, where were you? I said, I was out of the seat. I called it, send the pilot back. And he got into the seat. Jim Gehrig jumped into the seat, and he was mad. He knew they'd probably try to do something like this. So he was strapping in, and I was checking everything. And Terry said, keep your eyeballs open. And I was looking outside for any lights I could see. And suddenly, I saw one light, and then I saw three lights. The three different B-52s coming at me at 1,100 miles an hour, roughly, my mind stopped. I mean, how do I say this? My mind was going so fast with the adrenaline rush at that time that time seemed to stand still. And it was about maybe 2 seconds from the time I saw this plane coming directly at me head on until we hit. But I watched in very slow motion as the big gray shape came, and an 18,000-pound drop tank was coming right into the cockpit.
A mid-air collision of B-52 bombers is about to happen, and Major Don Harton is sitting in one of the cockpits. Super Typhoon Dinah is tearing up the South China Sea below, and decisions will have to be made in fractions of a second. We'll take a short break and then continue the story. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. You're listening to Major Don Harton and his story of survival in the earliest days of the U.S.'s entry into the Vietnam War. Don's nephew, Craig Collins, released a book titled Midair, with many more details than we're able to cover in this hour. But you're hearing Major Harton and Craig recount the dramatic highlights. When we left off, Don Harton was describing being in the cockpit of a B-52 over the South China Sea. He sees the lights of another B-52, and that plane is headed straight for him.
My mind was going so fast with the adrenaline rush at that time that time seemed to stand still. And it was about maybe 2 seconds from the time I saw this plane coming directly at me, head on, until we hit. But I watched in very slow motion as the big gray shape came and an 18,000-pound drop tank was coming right into the cockpit. I went through this thing you'd go through before you die, accidentally, of anger and denial and acceptance and all this stuff. I went through that in a couple of microseconds, and I realized I was going to die after all this work in my life to get to this point, and I'm going to die. But that drop tank slowly, slowly slid underneath us. I watched this big, huge tail slowly slide by on the right side, and I thought, whew, we missed. And then I recalculated in a microsecond, no, if their drop tank was going to hit me in the face, our drop tank is going to hit their vertical stabilizer, their tail. And it did. A big jerk, and then blooey, they saw the explosion about several different areas at 200 miles away, and it blew our right wing off, knocked their tail off. We went over and just rolled to the right, and everything went black in the cockpit because our engine electricity was coming from the right engines. I couldn't even see the instrument panel. I could barely see the yoke. I could just barely see the throttles. And it was blinding because my eyes were finally getting used to it when somebody ejected. And that fogged up the cockpit instantly, and I didn't realize we were going straight down. And I was trying to turn the plane, and I finally decided, and this is all happening in seconds, I decided it's about time to jettison this airplane and get out of it. So I sat bolt upright in the seat. Everything's ready. This is once-in-a-lifetime thing. And so I pulled the handles. The left one came up, and I couldn't get the right one up. So I said, heck with that, and I squeezed the trigger here, and nothing happened.
Don says he squeezed a few more times, tried the right handle again, nothing.
So I looked down, and I said, it better fire this time or I'm dead. And I looked down, tilted my head, squeezed the thing, and I got a 15G howitzer bullet. Threw me clear out of the plane.
His left leg was caught in the windstream. He felt a pull, and he knew his left hip was now out of joint.
Just then, the plane blew up as I went past the tail or somewhere. I sensed it going by.
Don was still in his seat. He was flying through the air. He thinks the seat actually saved him from the explosion, but now he was on his back, falling backwards. Something, he says, hit his left calf and tore it up. It's an injury he still struggles with today. He was trying to grasp what was happening.
And by the time I got squared away, I looked down and the ocean was on fire. It reminded me of Rome burning.
Craig is accustomed to telling this story. It's not often, though, that he hears his Uncle Don tell it.
I actually get choked up listening to that. It is
really?
Truly one of the most amazing stories in the history of aviation, and I researched it, and he is the only pilot I could find who survived an ejection at 30,000 feet after a catastrophic collision. And he's the only pilot to have parachuted into a Category 5 storm.
Typhoon Dinah was still below Don. He's in the parachute. He's falling. His life vests aren't inflating. and now he sees fire on the ocean.
I was doing all kinds of things, popping my May Wests, and they didn't work. Nothing I had worked.
So much of your equipment failed. It's astonishing to read through it. And then what you did have was created for survival in Arctic conditions.
That's right.
Not in the southern tropics. And Craig, the May West.
It's basically your life preserver, they call it.
Water wings.
Yeah, they were inflatable.
Which
and they
should have inflated by like a CO2 canister or something.
Yeah. And they drop down over your chest, hence the name May West.
So you're looking for the straw to manually blow it up?
Well, I didn't have the time. The whole sea was afire. There was two B-52s with bombs and about half a million gallons of gas, of aviation jet fuel, burning on the ocean. When you think about a typhoon, heat causes all this. And with all that extra heat, it created almost a nuclear cloud. But this big column of stuff came up at me, and it was rising at, I estimated at the time, 20,000 feet per minute, which is really fast.
He slipped his parachute a bit, he says, to try to get out of the way.
The parachute went away just far enough that it caught me and flipped me over. And I was rocking in my parachute, and I thought I was going to fall into the bowl of the parachute. But I finally popped my survival kit in my life raft, and that long moment arm stopped me.
He was a math and physics major, so he thought of that formula. And basically, the longer the arm of the pendulum, the slower it swings. So he dropped that about 30 to 50 feet down, and it just stopped him.
Parachute up above, then you, then the raft, then the survival kit. Right. So we've got...
And that's called the law of conservation of angular momentum.
And you, very good.
Wow. You had to have thought of that in a fraction of a second.
I actually thought of that coming down. I said, well, then pop your survival kit.
And it whipped you away from this...
No, it dropped down. By that time, the cloud had gone by, or the column of air or whatever, and the parachute stabilized. So I said, don't fool with this parachute. So I finally was coming down, getting close to the water, and it was all turbulent, like you couldn't believe. It was kind of a glowing turquoise from all the plankton being stirred up. Now, of course, I wasn't thinking about a lot of this at the time, but I've thought about it since, and that's what was happening. And the waves looked big, and they were giant waves, and I'm going to drop into it. And I said, oh, Lord, don't let me drop into that. Just leave me here in my parachute for the rest of my life. No, wait, let me rephrase that. You know, you're thinking, you're panicking. And that was the thing. I had to fight panic constantly.
Don fell into the sea, sinking only waist high because of his parachute.
I hit the water, and it jerked me. And I was going, and I mean, over 100 miles an hour, I know. And I'm spinning in the water and swallowing water, and I finally stabilized on my back, and then I tried to release the parachute, and it wouldn't release.
The water was violently turbulent. His life vests didn't inflate like they were supposed to, but he was still attached to the life raft.
And I got into that and pulled the survival kit in, and then I sat there and I looked, and I said, my God, the waves were about 70 feet high at the time.
Oh.
And there were just great big swells, and I'd go up, and then the wind would hit, and then bam, and come back down. And then you go up, and then you come back down. And it was just sickening. I was never so sick.
His survival kit had been designed for missions over the Arctic Cap when his B-52 was outfitted for a Cold War mission.
I pulled the survival kit in, and I pulled out all this stuff, and I had an Arctic survival sleeping bag, and I threw that in the water. It was all cramped into about an inch high, foot square thing, and it said, one each Arctic survival sleeping bag. I don't need this in the South Tennessee. I threw it over. Then I put together a little Hornet rifle, and then I looked at these books, How to Survive in the Arctic. Don't need that. How to Do This. Nothing in there was worth anything. I didn't have any survival signaling devices or even I had a mirror. I did get to save that because I put it in my pocket. There was nothing there that I could use, and I really wanted to signal anybody and call them on a radio, but I didn't have one.
The waves were throwing him up and down. He thought he saw an orange and black ship and then a white ocean liner, but he figured he must be hallucinating.
So I'm sitting there and thinking, what is going on? And then I see a flare shoot up right in front of the white ocean liner, and I go back down, and you have to wait. You only get about a 3-second vision of anything every 20 seconds or so. And I'm looking at all this stuff, and I just realized I'm crazy. I'm hallucinating.
You're not thinking I'm going to be rescued?
No. I was just thinking, this is a bad dream. Mm. And so the next thing I knew, I went up on one of these waves and went right over backwards. And I'm in the water, and I'm going down. And then I reached up to try to grab something, and I realized my left riser was still connected to me. And the parachute, after, you know, a few minutes in the water, generally weighs a couple of tons.
So it's sinking you.
It is pulling me down.
He reached for a survival knife in his pants pocket, and with the switchblade, he sawed himself free and swam up.
I had a helmet and boots on, too, so I'm glad I only weighed about 120 pounds at the time, because I wouldn't have survived if I'd have weighed 130. But I got to the top, grabbed the life raft, wadded it up into a ball about the size of a basketball, and I took this switchblade and put it back together, put it in my pocket, and then I got mad. And I had enough strength to blow up that life raft and just sit there and crawled in it and cussed for about 10 minutes, and finally I got that released. And you want to panic during this kind of stuff. You just want to say, oh, to heck with this. I want to panic and let me just float off and away. And I said, you're going to die if you don't do something about all this stuff now.
Don solved problem after problem. He says he had little sense of direction or time. But finally, and gradually, the typhoon died down. And then this happened.
Eric Helberg, who lived here in Sacramento for the rest of his life, was a tanker pilot. And he was supposed to refuel us, but he didn't have a plane to refuel. So he came down over the water, and at about 200 feet, he saw me, and they circled, and they came around, and they dropped a 20-man life raft to me from about 200 yards away. And I could see him waving in the doorway there.
The waves rolled Don up and down, and he could never reach the raft.
He said, why didn't you just swim over to that life raft? I said, it was out of phase with me. I was up here, and it was down there. And when I went down, it went up, and I never saw it again. Mm-hmm. I didn't know where it was. I really didn't have any or much sense of direction except for the sun through the clouds over in the east.
Hours passed. A shark swam nearby. And finally, an Air Force seaplane landed to rescue him.
And I saw him, and I just, oh, that's so neat. And I waved, and I took my gun out. It was a 38. You know, what can you do? I saw a shark. I thought, well, I'll save at least one bullet for myself. But I took the gun, and I emptied it into water, and I fired three shots in the air, and they didn't hear it. They were bouncing around, but they saw me. And so they taxied over to me, turned around, and then backed the plane up toward me. But when I got into the plane, there was a fellow sitting there, Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Anderman. And I said, whose crew are you on? And he goes, we were all so sick. We picked up two navigators, my electronic warfare officer, Jim Erbs, and my navigator, Jay Collier.
There were four of you that survived.
Yes.
That is not the end of the ordeal. The seaplane's hull had cracked when it landed in the ocean. Don Harton is still not safe. His story continues after a short break. You're listening to a special edition of Insight on Capital Public Radio. You are listening to a special edition of Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. And now, the rest of Don Harton's dramatic story of survival. A few years ago, he wrote it all down in a book he titled Arc Light 1, how he survived a mid-air collision of B-52s only to fall into one of the worst typhoons ever recorded. It seems appropriate to share his story today, to honor the airmen who lost their lives in that accident, and to honor all of those, like Major Don Harton, who fought in the Vietnam War. How did Don survive? His nephew, Craig Collins, says his uncle thinks clearly, is highly intelligent, solves problems, and most importantly, doesn't panic. You'll hear all of those traits as Don picks up the story. At this point, an Air Force seaplane has landed on the South China Sea to rescue him.
And so they taxied over to me, turned around, and then backed the plane up toward me. And I said, hey, wait a minute, you know, and there's a door on the left rear side of the plane, and there were people in it, but I wasn't paying attention to them because there's this great big propeller just about to hit me in the face. And I said, hey, wait a minute, and there was a float over here with a tie-down hook on it, or a ring. And I reached over and I grabbed that, and I wasn't going to let go. And I was holding on to that for dear life when suddenly this kid pops out of the water. I said, are you Neptune? Now, remember, I was crazy by this time.
And you'd been in the water how long?
About 5 hours.
Someone does pop up out of the water.
It really was. He was what we call a PJ, a parajumper. What it is they are Air Force SEALs. And he jumped into the water. These guys are the bravest guys in the world. Jumped into the water, and he pops up. And I said, well, hi, what are you, Neptune? And he looks at me. He says, hey, let go of that thing. Let go of that ring there, Lieutenant. I said, I'm not going to let go of it. They'll chop us to bits with that propeller. And he said, no, no. He said, see those people over there? He said, I'll pull you over to the door. I said, well, okay. So I let go, and he pulled me over to the door. They pulled me in, and they slipped my life raft and threw it away because they didn't want to rescue it a second time.
Which you didn't want them to do.
I didn't want them to. I wanted to save it. Oh. I wanted to have it for something in the backyard, you know. But they took off my flight suit, and all I had was my underwear, and they took off everything, wrapped me in a blanket, and tied me down into a seat and strapped me in.
And you're terribly seasick still.
They cut a Mae West in half and said, here, barf into this, and I happily barfed into that. It was pretty bad. And while we were rescuing, while we're still on the water, I'm sitting there strapped in, just happy as a clam and smiling and barfing happily into my half of my Mae West. And I looked down at the aisleway there, and a red bilge cover popped up and floated down the aisle. I said, hey, wait a minute. Are we going to sink? And he says, yeah, but we're going to take off now. So we tried to take off, and we hit these waves, and we tried about 5 or 6 times maybe to take off. And one time, the final time, we bounced into the air, and it goes, yeah, and it crashed.
An even worse impact, Don says, than the B-52 mid-air collision.
And I'm sitting there thinking, they just slit my life raft. I have nothing left to survive with, and I'm going to die anyway. And I looked out to the right wing, and that propeller was just crumpled.
Remember when Don was floating alone and thought he saw an orange and black ship? Well, apparently, it wasn't a hallucination.
I looked over the left hatch and looked through the porthole there, and there was that orange and black ship.
It was a Norwegian freighter, the Argo. The Argo's captain sent a smaller boat to pick up Don and the others. Don remembers getting into that boat and then realizing someone in the seaplane wasn't moving.
I looked up and I thought, hey, wait a minute. The guy sitting up there was the aircraft commander of the other plane, and he was just sitting there. I said, isn't he coming with us? And they said, no, Captain Robertson's dead. Joe Robertson was the aircraft commander on the other plane. When he ejected, it almost cut off his arm, and he died of shock and loss of blood in his life raft.
Captain Joe Robertson's body was transported back to the United States. He's buried in Sacramento. Don, how many people lost their lives in that accident?
Eight really fine men, Air Force people.
From Sacramento.
From Sacramento, all of them.
There just aren't a lot of people that could have done what he did and survived, period. So
actually, there probably were, but I think it took a lot of training, and I know a lot of these guys. I'm no hero, but I know some real heroes.
You're listening to Major Don Hardin. He is a retired Air Force pilot. He was co-pilot of a B-52 out of Mather Air Force Base that was involved in a mid-air collision. His nephew, Craig K. Collins, has written the story in a book titled Mid-Air. Don, in fact, has written his own book, and they are again remembering the details of that very vivid experience.
I'm pretty sure I would have just probably not even made it out of the plane, or most people wouldn't have.
You've had time and years and distance to think about this. Other than that 360-degree turn, could anything else have helped the two planes avoid each other midair?
Not from the situation we were at the time. However, I've thought about this constantly since that time, that had I flown while the pilot was out of the seat, had I grabbed the stick or the yoke and flown it up 100 feet or so, or done anything, 1,000 different things to stop this, I would have done it gladly. But from the time it was inevitable, that's when I discovered it, maybe 2 seconds before we hit them, and there's nothing you could do. And everything else was just fluff.
How did you look at life after that, after healing enough, and you continued your military career in a remarkable way, but did life seem different to you?
Yes, it did. In a lot of ways, I felt invulnerable. I felt not godlike or anything, but I felt like I was capable of doing anything after that. So what do? I fly another B-52 combat tour and got 30 missions in that. Then I got into F-105s and flew 165 combat missions over North Vietnam, most of them over North Vietnam. And that was supposed to be the most dangerous job of the war.
He did a double tour there and then became an instructor pilot for F-105s. He moved on to F-111s and flew a tour in that plane. And late in the war, Don Hardin was still flying. One reason, he says, was his passion for fighter planes. But there was another reason.
Survivor's guilt. That's what drove me for a lot.
Don talks to me about the Vietnam Memorial, the wall in Washington, D.C. that's built to read like a book.
Well, I was there in the start and the end of the war, and I can touch the second slab, which was where our eight people are, heart high. And there's eight guys there, but there's 12 guys on the last slab right at the deep V. Two F-105 buddies and 10 F-111 guys. Survivor's guilt's a terrible thing, and so is post-traumatic stress. And it just grabs you and holds you. And the worst thing of all is to not have anybody care or not want to hear the story. And you know, I wrote a book, and it's an awfully good book. Even my best friend read my book, and when he read it, he said, I didn't know you'd been through anything like that.
Did you fly the very last bombing mission?
Not. Well, yeah, actually. They called off the war literally on the end of the 12 days of Christmas, 1972, and I flew a mission, I think it was about the 5th of January. And then I said, that's it. The war's over. I get to go home. I've flown 5 combat tours, and you can't keep me here. So I went home.
His last mission was January 5th, 1973. They signed the Paris Peace Accords to end hostilities in Vietnam was January 27th
and 28th, but it was in Paris. So it depended on what part of the world you were in when it was signed.
So he flew a mission a little over 2 weeks before they signed the Paris Peace Accords.
From the beginning to the end.
Yeah, it was kind of fun.
Fun.
Oh,
I think you use that word a lot when you just want to go past what the reality is.
That's true. Yeah, it's survivor's guilt and all this other stuff. But hey, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right, you know. I got to tell you this couple of stories.
Before you go on to another story, could I say thank you for your service to our country?
Thank you so much for saying that. Do you know when I was first said thank you to? It was 1995.
Really?
Nobody wanted to hear anything before that. And I was treated badly, even by my own family. It just...
I can only reconcile in my own mind that there was so much we didn't understand.
Well, that's true. We were all lied to. We had depleted the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese so badly after the 68 Tet, literally within about a week, that they had 80% casualties and losses, and they lost their supplies, their safe areas, they lost everything. And they were actually asking us if they could surrender, and Johnson said no.
If you had this life to live over again?
I'd love it. It was so fun. It really was.
And that's when Don admits to being an adrenaline junkie, that these missions were a fix.
Apparently what happens to the human body, and I'm not sure about any of that, but it'd be an interesting study psychologically to find out what does this and why.
His mind is just wired differently.
Even as we're talking, his fingers are tapping and he's moving them. And I can tell that you're working something in your brain, Don.
If I can add something. So I've just had a blast traveling around with my uncle. I'm his wingman. He's Maverick. I'm Goose, I guess. But no. But he told me something while we were driving, and he said, if I were a recording instrument, I'd be an 8-track player because I'm always thinking of 8 things at once. And I have these different tracks. I have a music track because he was a drummer, and I've got this other track, and I've got – so he's got 8 different tracks going in his mind at the same time.
I can see
it. So it's a different sort of thing. So anyway.
I asked Don about his life today, whether he's free from the need for adrenaline, from the memories, the survivor's guilt. And finally – he lets me in on the other side of this experience.
Well, I lived in Mexico for 10 years, and down there I had a complete breakdown. I had to go through about 18 months of psychotherapy on my own and physical therapy and all kinds of things, massage therapy, water therapies, all kinds of things to be able to survive.
Okay.
I finally got through that, and I was raw as a – just raw – hurting all over, and I'd been that way for 30 years.
He did a lot of thinking, and he says slowly, very, very slowly, he recovered. How is it that you remember every detail, that your brain hasn't blacked this out at all to protect yourself?
Can I interject just real quick? In researching this book, I've talked to my uncle dozens of times about his war experiences, and he has pretty much a photographic memory. He would tell me these stories. He'd have the person's name, the date. This guy got shot down on this date, and it was over this place. And now on the internet, you can look up and they literally have every single plane that ever went down in the Vietnam War, and it's all listed. And he had the exact dates. He had the exact times. It was really remarkable. So he has this memory that's pretty remarkable anyway. So anyway, I'm sorry to interject.
And you asked me how I remembered everything. It took me 35 years to write my book. And I couldn't think of it. It's not that I couldn't think. It was that I wouldn't think of it. I wanted to keep it out of my mind. But then I wrote the book and I had to give speeches, and I still remember every little detail. So I finally got through that and I eventually wrote the book. And that helped a lot of things. And I've never been happier in my life. I live with 5 dogs. They rule my life and I love it. There's a lot of guys that are heroes, a lot of them. And I'm just one of the guys. I'd rather be that.
One of the guys, he says, just one of the guys. Thank you both for sharing the story, Craig, for the book, Midair. And again, Don, I'll repeat it. Thank you for your service to our country, to all of us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Retired Air Force pilot Don Harton. He lives in Las Vegas now, near Nellis Air Force Base, where you can find him visiting with friends and remembering history. His nephew, Craig Collins, is the author of the new book, Midair. We have photos and more information at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Cody Drabble and Kate Gonzalez. We had help from Helen Barrington, Antonio Muniz, and our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Casey Gardner. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.